the grade cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello, welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, England are dominating South Africa and Johannesburg as Ben Stokes gets compared to an iconic singer-songwriter, but he doesn't seem all that stoked about it. The Big Bash gets into the exciting who can finish fifth stage of the tournament in another edition of It's Just On. Australia knock England out of the Under-19 World Cup in a thrilling chase. India and New Zealand for some T20s, some other stuff. And ladies and gentlemen, we got him. Michael Vaughan is on the show, and hashtag AskTDC has a surprise birthday message as well. Obviously, this is all thanks to Budgie Smuggler, budgiesmuggler.com or budgiesmuggler.com.au, deciding on your preference. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined by Dave Edwards to my left and Sam Perry to my right. Boys, let's get straight into England and South Africa, or South Africa and England, as it is. And in light of Ben Stokes' interaction with a fan in Joburg, is there any sort of iconic send-offs in your own playing days, in your own career, that comes to mind, like a send-off that stayed in your mind?
Yes, he goes, and good morning to you both.
Morning all.
Good morning.
Good morning all. I again have to go back to my junior days.
Mm.
Remember playing against Hawkesbury in an AW Green Shield fixture at Chatswood Oval. I hit 100. That's just an opportunity for me to mention that, really.
That's terrific. That is terrific.
And the opening bowler, who actually went on to captain the Waratahs for a limited amount of time, when I got out for 100 off 100, he told me to fuck off back to the beach.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I just remember it so vividly. I remember thinking that I don't live anywhere near the beach.
Yeah.
I guess I might have had some sun in my hair at the time.
Yeah.
I can't remember what actually provoked that outburst.
Yeah.
But I never forgot it.
2000, 2001.
2001.
Mm. Dawson Leary.
I remember
Frost
that game.
Frost and Tips.
I remember that game.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
How many did you get?
Don't remember.
Yeah.
It wasn't 100 off 100.
You remember the game.
I remember the
innings. Don't remember any of your own involvement.
I remember taking a catch at second slip off your bowling, I think.
Oh, good.
This is the celebration of Dave's playing career under 16s every week. Des?
I've got two. One was also from AW Green Shield at Drummoyne Oval against Parramatta. It was like, we never call it AW Green Shield, but this is under 16s. And like after I nicked off for some unmemorable score, somebody at first slip called me a prick, which when you're 15 seems like awfully adult. Like I remember just being, I've never been called a prick before. Like you get called a prick for things, white collar crime or, some underhanded behavior towards women or something. When you're 15 years old, like you can't really do anything that renders you a prick. So whoever that kid was at first slip has grown up with some very hairy language.
Well, his father probably has called him a prick under his breath many times. He's or called his wife a prick or something, or a friend, and he's picked that up by
just
osmosis.
At 15, I was like, I hadn't done anything in that innings, I think, to render myself like of prick-worthy behaviour.
I would have thought so, no.
The other one was in grade cricket I was playing for Norths against Manly in third grade, and I just moved from Balmain, which is relevant.
Mm. I already know who the person is going to be involved in this story, as do many listeners, I suspect.
I was on 40-odd, 26, and got I got out to one where I lost it in the trees. I just lost the ball that went above my eye line. Must have been a slower ball or something. I can't remember, but I lost it. And it was one of those really ugly dismissals where you're crumpled in a heap as the ball cannons into the stumps. Mm-hmm. And from slips, someone said as I walked off, I'll fuck off back to Balmain.
I had exactly the same experience playing against Gordon, my old club from North Sydney, also in third grade, and walking past someone at mid-off who will remain nameless, but is a noted history teacher at a private school.
Right.
About 40-odd at the time.
Yeah. And
in years. And he just said, after I got out for a duck, nicking off, you should never have fucking left our club, mate.
Yeah.
Whispered it to me. Well, he was that close to me, whispered it.
My one, we were playing against Manly, and this guy said, fuck off back to Balmain from North. And I was just elated that he'd remembered me from this other club. He may or may not have a fairly senior post in Australian cricket at the moment.
Sure.
Always have to mention where they are now.
May or may not.
Yeah.
I remember one of...
I have to check if he's still working.
I think it was a fifth grade game, but I remember getting out, and this guy just screamed at me, and he had just...
Like rabada.
Yeah, and like mucus just fucking just spilled from his mouth, and just like his mouth was covered in mucus. Oh my God. Screamed at
Oh
me.
Man, I would love to get someone out and do that. Yeah. Just be so elated, I'm yelling and I'm just mucus everywhere.
That's a coronavirus reference, I think.
Another one, second grade game at Fairfield, slower ball that like just went wrong above the eye line. Yeah. Hit me like I ducked and it hit me like in the hip, and it was like on the way down, and then and then everyone laughed.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
like that was about. Nice. And then the incoming batsman said, "What happened there, mate? You didn't pick it up?" Or,
"Oh, nice. Love those conversations."
Had time to ask what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. What's this mate doing with it? Well, I didn't see it.
Definitely one of the things you get conditioned out of as you go up the grades, like any conversation between batsmen coming in and out is
it's
like
yuck. It's
just zero eye contact. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, should we talk about we'll just get straight into the Stokes incident. Where he was, what did the guy say to him? He said, allegedly, he said, "You look like
Ed Sheeran."
Yeah, Ed Sheeran, you ginger cunt or something. Mm. And then he, or some shit, yeah. And then Stokes replied, "Say it to me outside in the car park, you four-eyed,
you whatever. Fucking four-eyed."
Yeah.
Cunt.
Yeah, right.
Just finish it off. Right.
Finish it off. Always finish it off. Safe space.
It's a safe space.
Yeah,
online.
Although the Wanderers does not seem like a safe space at
South
all.
South Africa generally just like, what's going on with South Africa? It's been over years. It's fucking people just yelling at fucking players.
Blokes just can't walk off that ground without some kind of hectic fan interaction.
Yeah,
can they?
Mm. Yeah. Because we saw this last year, right? We saw this was it Sandpaper? When was last year? Yeah, 2018?
18.
So 2 years ago. Mm. Where, like, yeah, Warner was, like, getting yelled at when the guy off the field. And then it was all that chat where we heard about, like, the players' wives were getting abused. Mm. Like yelling out to the players' wives watching the game. That's fucking pretty grim. Then, obviously, like, all the Sonny Bill Williams masks stuff, like, with, like, South African officials wearing that. Like, what the fuck is going on in South Africa? What's going on there?
Mm.
Don't know.
South Africa's scary. And I mean, that is why I've said this before, I'm concerned about the one day series we're about to play in South Africa, because there is so much potential for scandal, weird time zone, end of a long summer, sandpaper, you know, anniversary coming up, the 2 year anniversary of sandpaper. Smith
AB
and Warner
back. A good player, though.
Good little player. Good little player. South Africa, for me, I mean, it's shrouded in my own memories of South Africa going at a cricket tour at the age of 15, getting violently ill in Cape Town, you know, not being able to go up Table Mountain as a result, which was disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Just a really scary place for mine. I remember being in a... I wasn't able to go, I really wanted to. It was the highlight of the trip, apparently. Mm. I remember being on a nightclub in Durban, on like second level of a nightclub.
How old were you?
15.
Mm. Oh, right.
You can get into the nightclub. Well, I think you can. We all did.
Okay.
I was the youngest player on a first 11 tour of South Africa.
Okay.
How old were you?
15.
Oh, just call runs?
A few, enough to cement my place for the next 3 years in the first 11.
Yeah, good little player.
Good little player.
Mm. At that age.
Yeah. I just remember people throwing money onto a busy street below from the nightclub, and like young beggars running out into like a hectic, you know, situation with traffic and just retrieving them. And myself as a 15-year-old thinking that's not normal.
Yeah.
It's not normal behaviour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Have not you ever had a bad day of cricket?
Yeah. Sorry?
Have you ever had a bad day of cricket?
Well, as you know, I've blocked out every terrible...
All your memories are amazing.
They're all positive.
They're so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Six free sessions of counselling through Medicare.
Good point.
Different types of hostility among international grounds.
Yep.
So obviously the Wanderers, it's like it's pretty hostile. Pakistan obviously has about 30 kilometres of security with matches. Yeah. So I guess diplomats and foreign agencies suggest that it can be hostile.
Yeah.
Mm. Though players suggest otherwise.
Chris Green said it was a bit hairy when he went there.
Yeah.
He chucks it.
Lord's long room. I mean, you're allowed to like
different type of hostility.
It is different type, and like you know,
class based.
People love the those stories of players walking out onto the ground, and you know, some toff will say, "Well, see you shortly."
Yeah. I remember the booing stuff with like Smith and Warner, and then the first game or the second game, second test was at Lord's, and it was like, "Oh yeah, that's gonna be a really hostile environment." Mm. Fucking 98-year-old man barely looking at. Games already in newspaper. Like peeking his eyes above the fucking the Herald.
Don't forget Sledge Bastion.
98-year-old man.
Sledge Bastion,
Is there much in this? So I can fucking broadcasters just turn the mics down and let the boys get on with it?
Well, like,
or, you know, are we in an era where we have to have unfettered access to every little minutia?
Well, because like the reaction I saw on Twitter is just like, oh, Ben Stokes is a prick, isn't he? Like, we love to hate the good players, and he is quite good. We had the conversation last week, in my opinion. He could be England's best ever player, so he's good.
Mm.
So therefore, we must hate him.
Widely oscillating and binary opinions on players.
Exactly. Mm. But, like, it goes to the thing of, like, are you entitled to yell anything at a player if you pay money to go and see the thing? Are you? I don't, it's just weird to me.
Well, entitled? Yeah, you, like, I mean, you can do it, and then you should leave the ground to be ejected. I mean, I don't think you're entitled to abuse people.
Well, that was the Adam Goods argument, wasn't it?
Mm.
Oh, yeah. By a lot of fans saying.
Yeah. Like, I was a bit like,
fair go.
I will, like, given Stokes was going to have a go, and he really emphasised the final word on that. He thought about it. He went there. I thought he could have done better with the sledge itself. Four eyes. Really, you know, I think it's a little bit lazy. It's more like, I expect more because I do respect him. I like Stokes in that environment. He's red-faced. He goes hard. He's aggressive. He encourages Joss Butler, you know, to stare him out. This is his domain. And someone calls him Ed Sheeran, and he looks at it, and it's a reflex. He looks at it. He's upset. And four eyes is what he does. He looks at it.
Someone's made a comment about his physical appearance, and he's then tried to react in kind and seen the first thing, that being glasses that the person's wearing.
And presumably he's had ginger before, so he'd be well-versed. I wouldn't know, you know, but he'd be well-versed in that. And he's looking, he's got, okay, what's the number one defining physical characteristic of this person I can get back at them with? And he just goes, four-eyed. He's like... You know,
but importantly,
think about that.
All of it's a bit lazy. All a bit pedestrian. Ginger, four eyes. Like, if he'd gone back and said, "You look like fucking James Corden or something," then maybe, you know, fair play. That's that's quick,
it's better
off the cuff.
The guy was into Warner a few years ago. Looked like James Corden.
Yeah,
which would change my views on Corden, frankly, for the better. That guy was right in Warner's grill. Wasn't he? Followed him and clapped him.
Yeah.
It was like a bit jarring because no one else was there.
Yeah.
You know, like at the SCG, the players are sitting in the members.
Mm.
And I don't reckon the players like that.
No.
They wouldn't like
that. There's so many things that they want to say, but they can't say because there's some 98-year-old bloke in front of them with his daughter.
He's probably a chief justice or something like that as well.
I think you're really, I don't know.
Are they all actors, the people that are kind of around them?
They are.
Surely they are. They're planted.
Yeah. It's like fan TV, all those presenters. They're just actors.
Yeah.
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 Well, in that series itself, England are going to win the series. They've set overnight South Africa 466 too many or some shit to win the series 3-1. This is amazing. It's a young England team over there. We spoke about some of the ages last week. The conversation seems to be they're actually picking on Joss Butler now if they're going to win the series in South Africa 3-1.
Mm.
But Joss Butler needs to sort it out. But it's an amazing series. The bowlers have done the job. South Africa's batting fucking terrible.
Yeah.
But I actually want to focus on Joe Root. Who scored a 50 in each innings of this match. He's now scored 48 test 50s, and he's got 17 hundreds. That is, it's weird that he's like the best, he's their best batsman. Can't hit hundreds. Yeah. He's got 17 of them.
It's a ratio, isn't it? He's been ratioed.
Yeah.
I just think we can't understand the way England plays cricket in Australia because we're quite narrow, you know. We're all about like prolificness, you know. It's like number three must be a big run getter, so must number four. New opening batsmen see off new ball, and then our quick bowlers destroy people and take lots of wickets, and that's it. Whereas England are like hodgepodge, you know. It's like Denley averages 30 and faces 100 balls, so that's kind of good. And then Joe Root, like, you know, pushes the game along, and then Joss Butler's batting 8, and Dom Bess is their spinner, and Joffre Archer can't get a game. There's commitment questions for him, and yet they're sort of winning. They're going to win 3-1. We can't compute how that works. We have only one way of winning. I don't know, man. Yeah. I think South Africa are quite cooked.
Oh, mate, I agree. But, like, isn't it weird that, like, a test match quality batsman, world-class batsman, Joe Root, can get to 50, and then, like, as soon as he gets to 50, he's, like, he's going to get out. Like, you can tell. Like, even in the
What's
first
What's the perfect ratio? I mean, is it, like, 25 test hundreds and 50 50s? Is that the ratio?
No.
One to two?
I think you want to have, like, over 50%
of
your, like, of those scores being over 100 kind of thing. So,
right.
Yeah, you're always going to have more 50s and 100s, generally. Well, I think Steve Smith's not that.
Yeah.
He's a freak, obviously. But, you don't want to have, like, fewer than 50%. That's what you don't want.
Yeah.
Just embarrassing.
I remember Bradman saying that, like, he never understood if someone got to 20, how they could get out. But that was
I'm
Bradman.
Sure he couldn't.
Yeah.
Good bloke. Bradman must have been very confused about how everyone else played cricket. Just shaking his head. Why are you getting out?
He's like
out?
Mark Waugh. Mate, just smack it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just use your feet to the spinners.
Can't get out if you don't.
Hit it on the full, just smack it.
Yeah, good player.
Good little player.
Good stick.
Mm.
Yeah, so Jofra Archer has missed the second, third, and fourth test. He missed the second and third test with an elbow injury, and then he was set to play the fourth test, and then it flared up, the elbow injury flared up in the warm-up, so he hasn't played again. But there's been heaps of questions about his like commitment and body language and fucking weird stuff like that, which doesn't sit that well, does it? Feels a bit, you know?
Yeah, yeah, all like red, all tabloid.
Little eyebrows
as well.
Being raised.
Yeah, eyebrow stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
The eye emoji.
My eye's twitching right now.
7 games, 30 wickets, 3 fifers, super over in the World Cup. Bowls 1,000 overs every time he plays. Yeah. You know, but like not the right kind of body management.
I read an article
from Jofra Archer. He's a bit slow sometimes. Not the right kind. It's like Kyrgios. Not the right kind of dickhead.
Yeah,
you know.
I remember
got to work on that.
Reading stuff like Australians saying like, "Oh, Jofra Archer's the most arrogant." Like it's like he is so good. Like filling it mid off with like a jump around his waist. That's funny. Mm. That's funny and good. And
daggering in his England kit.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah, more of that. More of that, please. Yeah. And then I was reading an article about he's had like a tough start to an international career. No bowler's like had a better start to a fucking international career. It's amazing. Yeah. He's 24. He's 25 in April, I think it is. Yeah. He's like coming to his prime. He's good.
It's all dog whistly. It's not tangible. It's like Mark Wood's done really well. He's come in. He's like hit heaps of sixes, taken a couple of fifers. We love Woody, Northerner. Yeah. You know, love the way he goes about it. Jofra Archer has to manage his body at different times. Bowls a bit slow. It's like, you know, more dirt on the more dirt, please. A little bit, you know, more sweat coming off the brow.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we'll accept
because
you.
Because he's fast, and we know how fast and dynamic he is. He must do that 100% of the time at all costs and times. Mm. And anything beneath that is a failure in our eyes.
You've bowled at 93 miles an hour. You must do that. Is your bar now? You must set that. It's like Australia with sport. We did really well in 1999. Mm. We must hit that mark in Olympics, in cricket, in any other sport. Mm. Otherwise, it's a failure.
Yeah. When in reality, we should really calibrate our benchmarking.
That's right.
Do you reckon this is a bit of a false dawn for England? I remember like when they won in Sri Lanka, they won 3-0. They've had like a couple of big away series victories recently, and it's a bit like, does that show anything?
South Africa are cooked, although we're not going to understand. Like, it's still, if we won like this over there, we'd be talking Australia shitloads. But, you know, half of South Africa's players, South Africa could have a team, half of whom are Colpack players, you know, playing in the UK. You know, Philander's retiring.
Yep.
Faf du Plessis retiring.
Yep.
You know, this is the culmination of like cricket becoming the big three. The Test cricket side struggling. You know, look at England. Like, what their top order is: Crawley, Sibley, Denley, who averages 30, and Joe Root, who you know as yet can't you know hit the hundreds that he probably should be hitting.
That he craves.
Yeah, that he craves.
Yeah.
Josh Butler again. Yeah. Mm. 16 runs, averaging 16, 115 runs.
Mm.
Broad and Archer are good. Mark Wood's good. Yeah. Dom Bess is their spinner.
Yeah.
So it's Jack Lee. I mean, is that what they're going to... And Root's talking about perhaps, you know, going on to be number one. Okay. Give it a second.
Yeah.
Let it breathe.
Yeah.
I would have thought.
Mm. Mm, I think you're probably right. So we're pleased with them winning 3-1, though.
I suppose so.
I reckon, that's fine.
Yeah. Mm. So this is just cause it's more cricket that's on.
Cricket
that's on. Okay, well, we'll roll that into the Big Bash, which is just on. Mm. And the stars are fucking at Pez. You've called it.
Yeah.
This is actually the most exciting part about the Big Bash so far. I lost 3 games in a row. They're still first.
Yep.
But it's happening again.
And I see Stoinis is saying, look, we're giving a couple of young kids a go.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, we're giving a couple of the young kids a go.
Mm-hmm. Did you say it like that?
You did it twice.
Right.
last thing you did is the thing you'll do forever.
Yes.
Which means it'll be a Sixers versus Brisbane Heat final.
Yeah,
last week AB de Villiers was a myth because he'd failed twice, but he only hit 70 out of 30 odds, so 70. Now he's the greatest ever.
Yeah.
Sixers heat.
Yeah, it's so as it stands, like 7 teams can make the finals. It's kind of, but like,
is that good though?
I don't know what
it is. We never know what's good with the Big Bash.
I don't know what it is. There's like talks about.
Do you want two Titans in a tightly run race? I don't know what a Titan is.
Yeah.
We don't know what the Big Bash is. We're talk about calibration.
Yeah.
There's an article from Neil Breen this week, the Sydney Morning Herald, saying Big Bash set for big crash.
Nice.
I'm thinking, was it, you know, that it's like on the downward slide? Because everything in cricket's always on the downward slide.
Yeah.
You know, since 1880.
That's cricket's dying, mate.
Yeah. He says, as quickly as the Big Bash appeared, it could disappear. There's fewer people going than 2016. So basically, because it was amazing in 2016, 2017, and it's not as good as that, it's therefore on the downward slide. It doesn't have relentless year-on-year growth.
Yeah.
Relentless yoy growth.
Yoy growth.
Yeah. Chops and growth.
You know, I don't know. Like, I just feel like people over the age of 30 will always struggle with the Big Bash in a way because life is a pursuit of recreating your life when you are 9 years old.
Mm.
And so there's no canary yellow. on screen, especially during this weekend. You know, we were saying this at the cafe, so it's always going to have. We're always going to have an uneasy relationship with it.
Do you guys go to a cafe before?
Yes. Yeah, we did, mate.
Oh, I was here waiting.
But it was Australia. It was Australia Day weekend this weekend, the long weekend, and you know, talk about formative years growing up. You just expect to turn on the television and see canary yellow. And while cricket is more colourful than ever before, and there are more games than ever before, the Big Bash is colourful, kid-friendly cricket.
Mm-hmm.
I feel slightly marginalised as a nostalgic 34-year-old parent of a 2-year-old boy who I can't bring to a Big Bash game. So I kind of fall into that neglected demographic.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I want to be able to turn on a home one day at 2:20 p.m. on Australia Day.
Yes.
And just kind of walk in and out of rooms, you know, go about my life and just leave it on till 10:30 p.m. And I can take in that match, but I don't necessarily need to be sitting in a seat or a stadium watching this colourful cricket. Just kind of I consume it throughout the day at my own leisure and time.
We're a neglected demographic.
Yeah.
I feel like 4-year-olds with 2-year-old children.
CA has neglected a very niche specific demographic.
That's right.
30-year-old white guys for the podcast. Exactly.
We're good for it. We've got money. We'll go. We'll spend.
What are you doing when you're walking in and out of rooms?
Just I only have like chores. A very small 2-bedroom house with about 100 metres squared internally. Mm. So I'm just usually going to the bathroom and or my bedroom because I have to pass through the television room to do everything.
Yeah.
Bouncing a basketball.
Yeah.
Moves.
Do you call it the television room?
Like the television room. Mm. Yeah. It's the 1950s.
I think that like... it's becoming its own sport, like sledging the Big Bash, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like every year, it's just like, oh, it's, you know, the crowds are up, and someone will say, no, the crowds are down. And someone will say, no, it's actually up if you do it by this average or that average or whatever. Like, I think it's kind of, it's carrying the can for a very sleepy test season. Like, it's meant to operate in symbiosis. If the test season is good and it's riveting, compelling, and you're drained from it, the Big Bash is perfect. It's just highlights, washes over you. Yeah. You get the odd close match, but the test season is just a walkover, and it's like, well, what is this?
Side plate. To the main, which is a nourishing test series, which we didn't have because I didn't feel like we had a summer, a cricketing summer.
Yeah.
I mean, the bushfires aside, we didn't have a summer in general, but a summer of cricket in 2019, 2020, I feel like we didn't quite have it. New Zealand, Pakistan, shitty series, offshore ODIs.
But that's a test cricket issue. That's like a South Africa cricket issue. That's that we need more, we need stronger opposition so the Big Bash can just wash over and we don't have to ask as much from it.
So is the answer that India keep all the money?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
So it's like if Australia was hosting one day during the IPL, you know, absolutely the Indian players would come over to this. Wouldn't you have thought?
Oh, hell yeah.
Frothing for it.
Frothing. Well, the garlic bled to all of this this meal talk is the Under-19 World Cup or something.
Very good.
Go on.
And Australia have done it again. I just remember like the one of the most like memorable moments of the Under-19 World Cup in the history of the tournament for us is when Lloyd Pope took 7 for whatever and he spun England out and we're thinking, here we go. This is Shane Warne with red hair.
Spun him out.
And now in Australia have another leg spinner who's been doing well, Tanvir Sanger. Who took 9 wickets in the first 3 games against? He took 4 against Nigeria, and we thought, this guy's a real deal.
We're on here.
Hell yeah. And then we beat England in a ridiculous run chase. I don't know if you saw this, Eddos. We were chasing 240. England got 240.
Right.
Australia are 8 for 200, or 200 for 8. Mm. 18 balls left, 2 wickets in hand, 40 runs to win. They win it off the last ball. Satisfying. Satiating.
How good.
Were you satiated? Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but I feel satiated now.
Mm. Just hearing those things.
And that talk about garlic bread before that you mentioned. Are we good? Because obviously the health of Australian cricket is dictated by the future, and the future being the Under-19s. Yep. Are we primed to win this tournament? Because we need it.
I think we're second favourite. India are short favourites.
Right.
Well, again, if you go into the search function of Instagram and see how good like 8-year-old kids are.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You can just extrapolate that and see how good their 19s.
That's a very strange sentence in isolation.
Pakistan have a 14-year-old playing for them and Nazim Shah, who's 16 in the Under-19 World Cup. I like that stuff.
Mm.
Australia don't have any of that. They just have Under-19s.
We've got Jake Fraser-McGurk.
Yep. Cool. New Zealand are hosting India at the moment. They're playing some ODIs and some T20s. Are you guys really into that?
Okay, you know.
Mate, there's so much fucking cricket on, man.
It's just on.
I'm trying.
But like, New Zealand were just here, then they went home for a bit, then they come back for 3 ODIs.
How can they be up for this?
Yeah, they're not up for it.
How can they be?
Well, it's India, I suppose. So it's a big deal.
it's a big deal.
These people watching it on TV.
There's a big TV audience.
TV audience.
I get it now. Broadcast revenues.
Yeah, exactly. And that's our entire summation of world cricket, as we know.
I'm going to put my hand up and say I know almost zero about what's going
to happen. But isn't that the right amount, Tess? Isn't that the right amount for
probably,
this series?
Probably not for a wide-ranging podcast.
Yeah,
probably
but,
not.
Yeah, but like it's just cricket that will go past. Like it's those two other ODI matches in India that Australia played that we've already forgotten about. But I remember the 10-wicket win in that one match series where we won 1-0.
Did you have a view on David Hussey's comments?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, we'll go back to the Big Bash. Mm. Should be looking at the agenda, seeing I'm running the show, right?
Well, I mean, you know, these are the colourful moments that the game throws up. These are the little scraps that CA does throw towards 34-year-olds with two-year-old children.
Yeah.
You know, the forgotten demographic.
Yeah.
We can have views on David Hussey.
Well, so do you want to run through what happens, Pez, for the listeners out there?
So, for the listeners out there who aren't aware, David Hussey is the Melbourne Stars coach, newly minted Melbourne Stars coach, and he gave a live interview on TV with Channel 7, I believe. Yeah,
yes,
it was Channel 7. Yeah. And he made mention of the fact that he'd walked onto the wicket before the game with spikes on his shoes. He later alleged this was a joke, but he was picked up on it by the commentators. Brendan McCullum said, you walked on the wicket with spikes before the game. He said, yeah, of course I did. I needed to see how. I'm paraphrasing here because I needed to see how, you know, whether the wicket would spin. You know, this is the attention to detail. Brendan McCullum said, you know, I think Jason Richardson said that. The attention to detail that Hussey goes to. And it was a little bit awkward in the commentary box. Anyway, later on, he was charged and fined $2,000 by Cricket Australia for, I think it was like, a conduct charge because he said, I didn't actually do it, I was joking. And what that did was precipitate like a raft of outrage from former professionals online saying, you know, we are just going to have to go back to our asinine comments, you know, no personality on TV anymore. This is a joke. Warn us them to retract that, to retract that fine. These are scraps.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I don't think it's a thing of just like, oh, we'll just have to go back and say nothing.
But it's were those comments funny or value adding?
No, not funny, but also like he's obviously joking. And so like, what's the point of fucking fining him? Like, what's
Yeah.
I don't know. I just be like, oh Christ.
I welcome the asinine comments.
Got more of it?
I'd like to see some more just on message comments from coaches in general. Just keep it fucking on message. Don't stray.
Wouldn't it be better if T20 start having like some real wild wickets, like wickets that actually spin, and then like 14 is a good score? Yeah. Oh, that's what I'm watching. I'm watching that Big Bash game. 14 plays 10.
David Hussey's a larrikin. You know what I mean? He's a larrikin of the game.
He was a player's player, wasn't he?
He's a player's player.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, David.
Yeah, he was.
Can you imagine, like, you know, other head coaches saying.
Why are we all smiling maniacally while saying this?
Yeah. We spoke to him once.
Imagine Langer saying that, like Gillespie, Bayliss, Greg Shepherd, Andrew McDonald. Oh yeah, I walked on the wicket with spikes on. Like, I just love that, like that even if it's a joke, just that mentality. And a bit of a rapscallion, a bit of a scallywag. And the players have come out in vocal unison, defending his right to say
to
these
say
kind of these kind of amazing stock shit. But he's been censored. Anyway, I look forward to Tom Morris reporting from the boundary for the Stars.
What happened with that? There's no smoke.
The Stars are playing the finals. We'll see Tom there. He's very welcome.
Yeah,
apparently.
Yeah,
so he's welcome. We'll see.
Yeah, I'd look at that.
We defend Hussey's right to shit chat.
All right, once again, a wide range of topics here on the Great Cricket Podcast. Michael Vaughan is on the show, or is he? Let's find out.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Fellas, we got him. We did it. It was a long chase. And I think with a sense of timing, this man has waited until he's about to exit the country to do this interview. So let me read out some statistics, some good ones too. 82 tests, nearly 6,000 runs, an average of 41, 18 50s, 18 tons, 268 first-class matches, 16,295 runs, 68 50s, 42 tons. More than that, as England's captain during the 05 Ashes, he's the chief architect of Australia's deepest cricketing pain. This century, Instagram shows him to have a wonderful rig. And according to our DMs, he's a prolific blocker of people on social social media as well. I'm, of course, talking about Michael Vaughan. Michael, welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Just about to catch a flight, actually. So I can say what I want on this podcast.
Exactly.
I'm going home.
Beautiful, beautiful.
You can't get me if I abuse you all.
That would be good, actually. That's good. It's good copy. Michael, you're a man. You're obviously a man from the north of England, proud cricketing region. What's your relationship to club cricket to kick things off?
Oh, my dad was the third 11 captain at Worsley Cricket Club in Manchester when I was growing up in the Manchester Association. So as a kid, I used to always be on the sidelines, nicking the bats, smacking balls onto the pitch. Moved to Sheffield, I think I was nine. We joined a local club called Sheffield Collegiate. My brother was there as well. And we played from the age of 9 of 10 all the way through. So I went from the 9s to the 10s, right through to the 16s. To the fourth 11 on a Sunday, to the third 11 on a Saturday, wow. Right into the first 11 on a Saturday afternoon. And that's where I learnt the game. You always talk about the international game because that's what everyone kind of sees you for. And Duncan Fletcher was a great coach, but I learnt the game playing in that first 11 on a Saturday afternoon with, when I was 15, 16, I was around accountants, policemen, painters and decorators, bitter or lager, that's all you could have after play. You just had to choose one. Travelling in cars with these guys to the likes of Scarborough, to Cleethorpes. I got abused all the time, but it kind of made me what I want. Porn magazines, you had to kind of get to know a few of them. They were always in the dressing room as a young kid. I had overseas pros. So when I used to get abused by quite a few of the clubs because I was this young whippersnapper that people were talking about, and the senior pros in the other team would try to pick on me, particularly the bowlers. That didn't kind of go for too long because about my second year playing, Kenny Benjamin was my overseas pro. Oh,
wow.
So I just stood up mid-on and just said, he's abused me, just bowl some bounces at him. And then Ian Bishop came. We had Ian Bishop as an overseas pro. So from getting abused quite early in my career in the first 11 at my local club, everyone started to be nice because I had Ian Bishop and Kenny Benjamin bowling for me. So it was, that's what made me as a cricketer all those early days. They're your foundations.
You say that your father played third 11 cricket for Worsley, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, your excellent accent. What was he like as a cricketer? I mean, third 11, obviously not first 11, but very instrumental, I imagine. Was he a batsman? Was he a bowler? Was he a throwdown merchant? Good drinker,
yeah. He was a social cat. He was a captain, but I think it was because he was good at arranging the nights out afterwards. He used to bowl these in-swingers at about 30 miles an hour. He used to club it with his St. Peter bat. So he had a St. Peter. Big old piece of willow, tried to launch it out of the ground. Batted about 8 or 9. No, he enjoyed it. My love of cricket came through him and my mum. My mum's side of the family, actually, my great-great-great-grandfathers were the Tilsley brothers that played for Lancashire in England back in the 20s and 30s, and you only have to Google the Tilsley brothers, and they are a lot better than I am at the game of cricket. They won pretty much everything. We still have the Rose Bowl that they won. They won the championship back in, I don't know what year it was, 30-something, and they got given a Rose Bowl, and I have that Rose Bowl still now. So I think it's my dad will take the kind of all the credit, but it was not my dad's kind of ability that I took out my mum's side of the family that I got my cricketing skills from.
Are you still at all, attached to club cricket? I remember seeing a thing for, I think it was like Nat West, you did a thing like The Secret Cricketer where you dressed up as, what was the character's name?
Not sure of his name, but it was Nat
Gary Wilson.
Gary Wilson. Gary.
You turned up like those NBA commercials where you actually have the full...
It was a Kyrie.
The full disguise on. And then you made 24 or something like that and got out.
Very club cricket, yeah. Smacked a couple of cover drives and then nicked off.
I was this... Yeah, they put me as this fat chap with a big beard and I just arrived at the plane. This cricket ground, that I think it was the club called Goldsborough.
Yeah.
I think it was Goldsborough. And they'd been...
They got bowled out for zero. Yeah,
the heaviest defeat ever in the history of the game. So they wanted to recreate that game, and the drama was me arriving halfway through the first innings, which we were in the field. No one knew who I was. I stroll on the pitch. Even the captain kind of had an idea, but he'd not been told anything. The rest of my team and certainly the opposing team didn't have a clue, and there was hidden cameras everywhere. And I stroll on the pitch, and the first thing that happens is the skyer. I'm under a sky, and that wasn't meant to happen because I wasn't meant to get in a huddle so they could hear my voice. And I surprisingly, I took the catch, so everyone came around. I was like shoving him away, saying, "Come get on with the game." And then the director just came up to me and he said, "Oh, you know, you get 50 not out and winners the game." I think I went in at number 3 or 4. Well, you know, on a club ground, which was
always precious,
wasn't the Oval,
not a good seeing day.
Yeah, with the sun coming down behind the bowler's arm with no side screen, it's not easy. Not easy. I was dropped on naught at mid off. Managed to get 24. Didn't walk. The umpire gave me out. He didn't know the gig. and then I kind of strolled out there once we got closer. We won the game, surprisingly. Yeah, that was a good crack. It was good to get in amongst a proper. That's proper like grade cricket, where you kind of in amongst a local club. It's just one little shed as a clubhouse, a few dressing rooms, not much. One little kind of entrance where you could get a pint of lager, and that's pretty much it. That's what club cricket's all about.
Michael, you've just moving on to the international stuff, you've obviously had like a disproportionate amount of success against Australia, over 600 runs in a series at one point, won the 05 Ashes against, you know, McGrath, Warne, Pont and Gilchrist, etc. I guess my question is, like, why doesn't Australia scare you in any way? What's the secret there?
I'm very good at shifting out bullshit. I'm very good at kind of looking at things and realising that if you can act and pretend that it's not happening, you've got a chance of being successful. And you know, Australia had an incredible mentality, and what they were brilliant at was intimidating the England teams, and particularly individuals. And I kind of worked a way of pretending that they weren't going to intimidate me. Of course they did. They were a wonderful team. But the more I kind of conned myself into believing that I wasn't getting intimidated by them, the better I did. I was still petrified. I still was worried facing the likes of McGrath, Warne, you had Gilchrist, Hayden, Langer, Ricky Ponting, Steve Waugh. Steve Waugh in particular, he frightens the life out of me still.
Same.
He frightens me because he had this mentality in the morning. I mean, most of the Aussies would say morning and not much of a conversation. He wouldn't even speak to you. You know, he tried to belittle you into thinking that you were just not worthy of being on the pitch with him. And he's not that kind of guy. I've played golf with him and he's a good guy. But he had a great mentality of really knowing. I think he knew that he had a better team. He had, you know, strong players in that team. And I think he knew that he could intimidate most players around the world. And I reckon 80% of the time he did that. I conned him into thinking I was a lot more confident probably than they thought. Got away with a bit of luck in 2002 and 2005. Because I had success in 2002-2003. And then I got the captaincy. I could kind of con my team into believing that they weren't playing against the great Australian. They were just playing human beings. Of course, they were more than human beings. They were better than that. But we managed to con a few in 05 to believing that we could beat them.
But just on Steve Waugh, I know you've got a young lad, Michael. I mean, Steve Waugh's got a young lad as well. And you say he's a nice guy now, but we've had verified stories of his young lad playing second grade. He's a fully grown adult now. And but when his young lad was being sledged, Steve Waugh was walking around the boundary sledging the opposition second graders. I just wonder if that's kind of your approach with your young lad playing as well. I mean, former England captain, you carry a lot of weight there. Has that crossed your mind as a tactic to help your young lads?
Yeah, absolutely. If opposing teams want to get you know, into my lap, that's going to happen. He'll have to cope with it. He'll have to give it back. That's the game of cricket. But you know, the only thing I ever say, if it gets personal, well, you've got to stop that. It's nonsense when you hear personal abuse. If it's banter, if it's just trying to put the player off playing the game and watching the ball, nothing wrong with that. Steve Waugh was a pass master at that. You know, his ability to make a batsman think about the previous failures, make a batsman look into the future of potentially losing his place in the side. I'd say Steve Waugh was the best. He never abused personally, but he knew the psychological blows that he could take.
It's a time traveler of sledging.
Yeah, he certainly had a team that he knew he could back to basically dismantle any weakness in the opposing team.
I mean, sledging is quite topical at the moment. I mean, we've obviously seen Ben Stokes react quite viscerally to a fan making a comment, which we've already discussed earlier on the podcast, so I don't need to repeat that particular word again, which which we used quite liberally before. Ed Sheeran is the word I'm talking about. I mean, where do you stand these days on blokes in the crowd verbaling players? Is it just part of the game as a professional athlete? You kind of go out there and you have to expect these things, or is that just you know, village?
Well, you've got to expect that you're going to cop a bit, you know, and I think if you're complaining about someone, you know, trying to get into you and it's in good banter and there's no nasty words and they're not getting personal, I think as a player you've got to accept that. You know, it's all part of the entertainment. Particularly when you play away from home, you've got to expect that the opposing sides are going to try and put you under more pressure, say a few things, that's fine. But when it gets personal, I mean, I don't ultimately know exactly what this guy said at the Wanderers. All I knew, it was something to do with Ed Sheeran, and Stokes has responded. But I guess if you're going to get called anything, Ed Sheeran, I mean, he's a billionaire.
That's good.
He's writing the best songs in the globe. I mean, I wouldn't be too offended by that if I was Ben. I'm sure it was a little bit more than him mentioning that he's got ginger hair and he looks like Ed Sheeran. But I would give some advice to the chap. That if there's one England cricketer that I wouldn't be abusing, I'm pretty sure I've taken Stokes on. You know, pick on Joe Root. He's not hard. Pick on Joe. Joss, you know, Butler, you know, came out with some words that I'd not seen him use. I think cricket's in that precarious place where, because of, you know, I guess, the cameras now and the information that we get on social media, little things can deem to be a lot bigger than what they were. And these things have been happening forever in a day while the game's been played. You know, as long as it doesn't get too personal, that's why I was a bit disappointed in Joss, where he was personally abusing Vernon Philander. That's not him. Try and get into him. Yeah, try and off-put him in his game. But, you know, mentioning he's a big unit for Lander, but you know, you don't need to mention it through the stump mics. Mention it somewhere else where you know there's not a microphone. Be clever.
Well, Michael, it was possible, you know, Joss, who's struggling at the moment, was just trying to reinvent himself as a hard man, just trying anything to kind of be relevant to the side. Like, how are you meant to drop somebody who's so comprehensively nice as Joss is, and so many of his journalistic friends are letting us know now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's also an indication of where he's at, but maybe he is under a bit of pressure. And sometimes when you're under pressure, you're not quite yourself, and maybe that's an indication that Butler's just feeling a bit of the heat. Wonderful talent, got all the skills for the white ball, not quite transcended over to the red ball yet, but England will stick with him. He's a good guy, he's a good team member, and that goes a long way. He's been catching the ball pretty nicely behind the stumps. They obviously want him a bit more consistent with the bat, but I'm sure they'll stick with him for a while yet.
It's actually the opposite of what we do in Australia. If you are a nice guy, you're out of the team immediately.
Yeah. Suspicious. Yeah.
Leave the team now.
Don't understand that. But we're talking earlier in the show, Michael, about Joe Root. He's now got 48 Test 50, 1700s. Just trying to figure out like the mentality of like a world-class international batsman making it to 50, and then just like something in the brain is like, I now get out immediately.
Name in the paper.
Yeah, name in the paper.
He just can't be arsed. He wants to get to the bar early, doesn't he? I'm close with him. I speak to him a lot. I don't know why. I honestly don't know why. He's tinkered with his technique recently. I'm not too sure why he's done that. But to get that amount of 50s and not to, you know, get the three figures. I mean, he's got a great average in Test cricket, just under 50. Probably being greedy, that should be around 55 with the amount of times he gets. And he very rarely fails. For England to be successful here in a year and a half time, or whatever it is, 18 months, they're going to need Joe Root getting hundreds. You're not even competing out here with 50s and 60s. So it's so important that whatever's going through his mind, it probably is that he's just thinking too much. You know, sometimes in sport you can overcomplicate, overthink, and before you know it, you're a little bit drained by the time you've got the 50 and 60 because you've been thinking about getting the 100s. You've just got to allow it to happen. I'm a big believer, if players are getting out between 0 and 10, you've got an issue. If players are getting out between 50 and 100, it's not an issue. It's just a mental concentration issue, and that can be quite easily fixed. If you're getting a 50 and 60, 70, you're obviously doing a lot right to get there. There's more concern when you're getting out between 0 and 10.
Just on that, Michael, I mean, Joe mentioned that, you know, after this successful series against South Africa, that number one, you know, is kind of in sight. It may be the goal. You know, Ollie Pope's coming through, Tom Banton, you're a big supporter of his as well. How are you meant to become number one when Joe Denley averages 30 and the spinner is Dom Bess?
Oh, it's just chat. I mean, you can say it. You can have a vision. You all need a vision, you know, when you're leading a team and you're managing a team, you've got to have that vision. I've heard two visions now, that they want to be number one and also they want to compete here in 2 years' time, the miles off. I'm not being disrespectful because they've done some good things over in South Africa. Ollie Pope's a standout. Mark Woods, obviously, come through. They need pace. But still, the fundamental basics of being a number one side, I've got just a suspicion they're still lacking. They need a bit more pace. Mark Wood, can he run 18 games on the trot to get to Australia? Can he play five test matches here? Jofra Archer, can he kind of become a partnership with Wood. If that can happen, yes, they'll put many teams around the world under pressure. Ollie Pope looks a standout, but they haven't got a spinner. You know, Best got Pfeiffer. Disappointed that they didn't give him another game on the back of a Pfeiffer. I know the Wanderers is not historically a spin venue, but when you're playing a South Africa team, we've got to be honest, and it's not disrespecting South Africa. The South African supporters would say this about this team at the minute. They're a poor Test match team.
Just on Jofra. Sorry, Michael, go on.
Yeah, it's the poorest South Africa Test team I've seen. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, England have done well. They were 1-0 down. That's more of a concern to me that they actually lost a Test match to this South Africa team. But they've done some decent stuff. They've got Sibley and Crawley that look like they've got a chance of having success in Test match cricket. So there's some good stuff, but we shouldn't get too excited because the South Africa team have been pretty poor.
We kind of don't understand the chat about Jofra Archer here as well. I'm looking at an article from Martin Samuels saying Jofra Archer is the rocket man in England's attack, but is in steady retreat, getting slower, getting injured and having questions asked. I mean, for us, you know, he frightened us. So 30 wickets from 7 starts, 3 Pfeiffers, World Cup, bowled the super over, bowls 8,000 overs every time he plays. Yeah. Now he's injured and now people are kind of questioning his commitment. Can you explain that to Australians who would love to have Jofra Archer in their side?
Well, it's very much an English trait, I guess. You know, Jofra is coming to the England side. He won England the World Cup. I don't think England would have won the World Cup without Jofra Archer. He came into the Ashes, bowled great, was terrific, particularly at Lords, that spell that he produced to Steve Smith will be remembered for a long, long time. He then went to Henley and gets a sixer. Had an off game at Old Trafford. He just didn't quite get his rhythm. It was awful conditions for bowling on that first day, and then did pretty well in the last game at the Oval. And then he goes to New Zealand and struggled. You've got to remember, this is a young bowler that's not bowled a great deal with the Kookaburra ball. So I think we sometimes expect a little bit too much. You know, when you start talking paces, you know, the way that he bowls and the amount of cricket that he plays, my one concern is he probably won't be that 90 miles an hour bowler when he's playing the IPL, when he's playing 3 formats for England. I don't think he'll be able to bowl 90 miles an hour consistently. He just doesn't look to be that kind of bowler. But he's skillful, he's different, he can hold a bat as well, he's a character. I would say to England, whether they've been briefing people in the media to write that, only they can answer that question. I don't know, but if they have, it's bang out of order. Because in terms of a young talent, he's different because he's probably going to take some managing. He's probably going to be a little bit late at times. Well, they've got to just nip that in the bud. They've got to manage him. They've got to expect that, you know, there will be times when he's not quite as consistent, but there will be times where out of nowhere he'll produce a spell like he did against Steve Smith at Lords. And if I was them, I'd be managing him because for what I see, he'll win England games of cricket across all the 3 formats. So do as much as they can to make sure that they find out exactly who he is and work out how to manage him the best way possible.
Michael, just back to something we touched on at the start of the podcast, how Australians are deeply scarred, still to this day, by the 2005 Ashes series. Obviously, one of the greatest test series in our lifetime. What are your kind of greatest moments of that series? You know, we're not talking about Ponting choosing to bowl at Edgbaston or McGrath rolling his ankle when Ponting got run out by Gary Pratt. All great moments, which I'm sure English people rejoiced at the time. But your personal greatest memories of that series?
I mean, it was a build-up over 2 years. We decided to go with younger players. Over the course of the 2 years, from 3 to 5, we kind of got rid of Nasser. In a nice way, he'd got 100 against New Zealand. It wasn't just Nash, you got on. He kind of made his own decision. Alex Stewart, Darren Goff, Andy Carrick didn't play. Mark Butcher had kind of been passed by. And then Graham Thorpe was playing the game before, and he had a bit of a dodgy back. And we decided to go with Ian Bell. Kevin Peterson came into the side. Simon Jones. Obviously, Geraint Jones behind it. We just kind of produced a team that we felt had no scars against Australia. We gambled because it's a big risk to go into a big series like that with not a great deal of experience against Australia. But I felt the experience that a lot of the players that I'd mentioned had were bad experiences. And I think you can have a lot of baggage and it can really affect you if things don't go well in an early part of the series, which happened. We lose at Lords, but because all the young kids had never really played against Australia, we could con them into believing that didn't matter at Lords, and we go again at Edgbaston and go with the same mentality that we'd had the previous year. We'd won 7 test matches on the trot in England in 2004. We'd won in South Africa. So we were playing cricket that we knew if we could up our game, we could compete with Australia. But I think the best thing now, a long way from that series, 15 years on, it's more what it did for the game and more that, you know, you're asking me about it now. That you know, I think all the players that were involved on both sides, we kind of all sit back and go, it's actually proud to be involved in a series that people still talk about because of the way that it was played, the individuals that were playing, the dramatic moments pretty much across every single test match. And test match cricket needs that. And I thought actually last year's Ashes was getting very, very close. You know, when England won at Headingley, I thought, wait a minute, this is going to be going right down to the wire. And then obviously England just didn't arrive at Old Trafford. But, you know, the year that we had in 19, it felt the closest that cricket has got to 2005 because of the World Cup. The World Cup final was on terrestrial TV. 7 or 8 million people watched it. And that was a big thing for the game back home. So it does feel like 2019... certainly will have the same impact that 2005 had on supporters and potentially new supporters of the game.
Michael, this is obviously a very detailed interview. I hope people in the UK are enjoying this as well. But, I mean, you know, as many of our audience will have seen when we announced that you'd be coming on the cast, there was a raft of comments underneath that you no doubt read of people saying, can you ask him why he blocked me?
Simple method on Twitter.
Please.
So generally, people get blocked if they're not themselves.
Right.
So if their Twitter handle is AZ51254, and they come on and abuse, get rid of them.
This is the Great Cricketer podcast, an anonymous Twitter account
started by three people from the internet.
Yeah, anyone that abuses or tries to be smart and they're not themselves, they can get effed. And they just get blocked straight away. Those that have been swarmy over 2 or 3 tweets, and you just think, oh, shut up, get rid of them. You know, I think that's why Twitter's great, because of that. You know, I love interacting. I interact with so many people, and I like Twitter. I think it's going a little bit vile at times. Yeah. I really do. I think there's times where you look at it and going, come on. Yeah. You know, any small error that someone makes, everyone's all over them. It's like, come on, we're human beings. People make mistakes. That's why life's great. But generally, I'm very open and honest to people on Twitter. I like the comments back. But if you're not yourself and your handle, I can't see who you are, and it's not a picture that I can kind of put a face to the abuse, I'm sorry, you can get fucked. You're going to get blocked. Simple.
So do you think NASA should have batted at the Gabba in 2003?
To be fair to NASA, if he had batted, we'd have still lost, and he wouldn't be as famous for it. So in terms of his fame, he did the right decision.
Good point.
Michael Vaughan, now you got a flight to catch. Thanks for holding us off until now, until you were about to get out of the country. Very much appreciate your time. Thanks for coming out here to Australia as well. And I guess we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's to be honest with you, your podcast, I didn't realise it was that popular, but you're quite popular. I've seen a few tweets, people like it. So whether they like me on it, I'm not too sure. But thanks for having me.
No worries, mate. Safe flight.
Cheers, guys.
Gentlemen, as you would have seen, the Australia Day Awards took place over the weekend. Australia Day. Some people call it Australia Day.
Yeah.
James Mukey.
Yeah.
Won the Australian of the Year for preventing blindness.
Yeah. That's new information for me. I did not know that.
Okay. I think fewer people engaging with Australia Day generally for extremely understandable reasons.
Yeah.
Bettina Arndt, I think is how you say it. She received an award for service to gender equity, men's rights activist. Mm-hmm. You know, all this chat about great Australians just does make me think about Budgie.
Oh, there we go. Oh, there we the link. Go. I didn't know what you were talking about there's for a the second link. There.
Tell you what.
Yeah.
Stretching hard for that one.
If there was an award for snugly fitting customizable swimwear.
Yeah. If there was.
Produced and developed onshore.
Yeah. Mm. It's onshore stuff.
It's onshore. Yeah. Not offshore like our ODIs.
Yes, that's right.
And it will never be offshore like our ODIs.
Yeah.
Oh. They've made that personal commitment to
us. We might speak to Lenny next week, actually, in the studio, that people can listen to.
CEO of Budget Smuggler.
CEO of Budget Smuggler.
Yeah. So it's Ben Stokes smuggling. Often see him smuggling. All the Australian players are wearing budgies as well.
I wonder whether we can ask CEO Budgie Smuggler Linney next week whether you know Stokes will be uninvited from wearing them given his very poor behaviour. Then again,
I welcome that.
Well, we'll ask Linney. He's a CEO.
No, but I'll decide what's good for the company.
Well, then again, Linney was a CEO when about seven blokes went to the Malaysian Grand Prix drunk shoeies and ended up in jail. So
Yeah.
He stood by them, I believe.
Yeah, right. And he'll stand by Ben Stokes as well.
We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. I'm putting words in his mouth now. Yeah. What's the website?
Yeah, that's a good point. Budgiesmuggler.com.au.
Jesus. Hashtag AskTGC. As Pez tries to destroy the studio. One swift action at a time. Just before we get into that, there was an article published through Premier Cricket New South Wales this week where Robbie Aitken, that's a teammate of yours, Pez, a former teammate of yours, has equaled the most first-grade matches ever in the history of the first-grade competition, circa 460-odd.
Something like that.
Heaps of games. He's played heaps of games of first grade.
Yeah.
That's a lot, man. That's a good
achievement. A lot.
Congratulations.
Congratulations to Robbie Aitken, equaled, most number of first grade games in the history of first grade cricket. Obviously, he'll surpass it next week, injury permitting.
If selected.
For the Bears. Robbie is extremely athletic. He is lithe.
How old is
he? You remember him, Dave? How old is he? He'd be in his 40s, Robbie.
Yeah.
But very athletic. You could see how the body survives. Something like, 8,000 runs, 600 wickets or something.
Absolute glutton.
Just a glutton for involvement. Couldn't bowl one of those Doosra balls with his, out of the front of his fingers. He can spin it the other way.
He was so hard to play in the nets.
Yeah.
The hardest spinner I've ever had to play in the nets.
Levers for days. And can still get around. It's remarkable. And don't shower next to him.
Callum McLeod kicks off hashtag AskTGC this week. He says, "Hey boys, I have unfortunately been alphaed into sending this message on behalf of my dad. Enjoy."
Nice.
Since two of you,
so this is the dad. This is the dad writing. Yeah, it is. I believe it is.
Sure.
Yeah.
"Since two of you have young kids, as do many of the listeners and great cricketers around the world, I'd like to propose a regular segment on, in parentheses, positive parenting and cricket." Close. Quotation marks, not parentheses.
He started with parentheses and then closed with quotation grammar. Marks.
Fuck me. "Every second message you read out relates to a parent / child / cricket issue. Yes. To kick off this formal segment, please discuss this moral dilemma and in doing so, hopefully appease my conscience and feelings of guilt which have haunted me for the past three seasons. Picture this. Fourth grade game, one dayer, 45 overs per team and we're chasing 190 and a down.
Must be a one down.
Yeah, one down for 130. 8 overs to go. I am captain, age 53, the only player aged over 20. I'm batting with my son, age 16. I've hit a quick fire 30-odd, and my son, who opened the batting, is on 17 after 37 overs, making Jeff Boycott look like Glenn Maxwell. The next two batsmen in are in form and known for their hard hitting. What would you do? Continue to place blind fatherly faith in your son's ability and potential, despite the bleeding obvious that his go-to shot, a push to third man, will not get us across the line, or, as I did, wait until he hits the ball directly to mid-off, call yes, knowing he has a good son. He will listen to the call and get run out at the bowler's end and thereby get some big hitters into the middle as well as teaching him a life lesson. Please discuss what is appropriate and positive parenting in this real-life situation. Family first or team first? P.S. The next few batsmen all failed and we got rolled for 160-odd. P.P.S. The concerned son has subsequently not played cricket the past two seasons."
Okay.
Is that clear?
That's clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was from the father.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, so renowned psychologist Stephen Bidoff.
Here we go.
Is a big proponent of fathers being there for their sons. Yeah. He says if you work 50 to 60 hour weeks, it is next to impossible to be a present father.
Mm-hmm.
So to consider that. So the first thing we need to do is congratulate Mr. McLeod for engineering a situation where he's engaged in a ritual with his son.
Can I just stop you there? Dave Warner won Australian Father of the Year, didn't he? A couple of years ago.
And the photo shoot was him, Candace, and his children on a cliff face, and he was wearing full ODI kit playing with his family.
Which I think is enough.
Which made me have a lot of questions about, firstly, why are you wearing that outfit with your family?
Why
secondly,
do we do
why
that?
Are you on a cliff with your family?
Yeah,
I'd do that if I played ODIs for Australia.
I stand by my comment last week. Yeah. I'd fucking love international cricket if I played it.
Yeah. So with Mr. McLeod, on this occasion, he's trying to win a game. Like, they're trying to win a game for their team. And they're engaged in a ritual. They're batting together, right? So, and with the situation, Bidoff talks about the importance of ritual for boys and for men, especially for boys. It doesn't have to be like spiritual Amazonian quests, you know, carrying canoes up mountains and stuff like that. He actually talks about things like backyard cricket, where sons are taught to accept the umpire's decision, deal with difficult situations in a controlled environment. This is good for their growth. Okay. So this is a ritual situation. This is good.
Yeah.
But Mr. McLeod is Mr. Trick here. The son, yes, needed to go for the sake of the team.
Does Bidoff like talk about this in his book?
Essentially, okay. I want to channel this through the prism of Bidoff. But like what Mr. McLeod needed to do was encourage his son to hit out or get out.
Yeah.
Right? Instead...
yeah, be good or fuck off.
Instead, the father's opted to deceive and betray his son in the most brutal way possible, strategically barbecuing him.
Yeah.
Based on what was shown to be poor judgment, the subsequent batsman got out. Everybody truly lost. He couldn't even demonstrate to his son afterwards that what he did was correct.
Yeah.
Concept was right. Tactics disastrous.
And he quit playing for the last 2 seasons.
Yeah, so the life lesson that Mr. McLeod has taught his son is that if you're in a moral bind, as he was, don't be afraid to cheat and deceive the people you love to get what you want, even if you're wrong about it.
Yeah, interesting.
So well done. So yeah, and also he suggests we have a segment called Positive Parenting in Cricket. Don't tell us what to fucking name our segment.
Well, I think is it Bidoff that says, you know, from the ages of 0 to 6, the mother is the most important figure in the child's life. And then from the ages of about 6 onwards to maybe 15 or 16, it kind of reverses. And then the father is the most important. So anything
well,
you
do... Like he qualifies it. He's like, the dad's got to be there. Around, gotta be there. But the kid, the son, starts noticing the father much more from about 5 or 6.
Yep.
So it's not like dads have just got a free pass for 5 or 6
years.
0 to 6,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm watching BBL. Alex Carey's bad. He's sitting him clean.
Tom Patton gives him a whack, doesn't he? Yeah. He's a clean ball. Yeah.
Can you make up that formula? No, Carey's in.
He's going to replace Payne one day.
He's a clean ball.
Yeah,
Teeth-based selection. Would you reckon you guys will send? Do you reckon you guys will
send him to cricket?
The first match that you guys take your sons to will be what would be Big Bash?
I've already
test?
Done it.
You already done it?
Preston Oval, yeah.
Okay, a grade.
Oh, so a grade cricket game.
Yeah.
Well, it was not even grade.
What? Oh, right.
Yeah.
What was it?
I don't know. It was Melbourne, some fucking weird Melbourne comp.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm talking about the professional.
Oh, pro, yeah.
Yeah, like you're paying for a ticket.
Yeah.
I haven't taken him to a cricket. I've taken him to
how old are you saying?
No, what's the first game? Is it a Big Bash game? Is it an ODI? What format of cricket is the first match that I've taken to professionally? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's got to be a test. Like,
it's probably going to have to be a test match because an Ashes test match. Something that goes throughout the entire day that I can kind of maybe get a pass out. So we can go in and out.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
He's still having naps at the moment, so I could go back at the lunch break, put him down for 2 hours, come back actually after the session. Yeah. I wouldn't do any of those things.
Oh, no. It sounds like a lot of
fucking work.
Yeah. I saw a kid that would be the same age as my son, would have been 20 months old, nearly 2 years old, at Optus Stadium. Poor kid. Mm. This kid had no idea what was going on. Just standing there, bored. Yeah. Probably a bit too early for the demographic.
But even an afternoon game of BBL, which would end at like 6:30, and you've got to think about getting out of the stadium, getting home, public transport. We put him down at 7 p.m, so I can't go to a cricket game with him until he's at least 38.
ODI?
It'll be an ODI, they're still around.
Against Nepal. In Nepal.
In Nepal. Yeah. Go to the Himalayas, catch an ODI. Okay. This one is from Josh Poor. Hey, lads. Have recently moved from a metro area away from the big smoke, brackets, literally the big smoke, from Melbourne. Our country is burning quicker than my desire to bowl mediocre 120 km/h in-swingers is dwindling.
Nice.
Another brackets, I'll call them in-swingers. Now, you didn't close the brackets, just another bracket.
Now they're opening up. Yeah.
I'll call them in-swingers because I often get hit through mid-wicket, but I just bowl a shit line. Mm-hmm. Close brackets eventually to a rural area for work.
You need a 2 there to make that correct.
Several commutes back and forth between the two have now been made easier by listening to the TGC podcast. I particularly like Zorba. Brackets. I will call him that, despite never having met, and undoubtedly would be alphaed by him if I ever did, close brackets, saying how much he hates grade cricket. What a true sentiment, but nevertheless, the notion of salad has come about, and I accidentally used it in conversation with my partner the other day, to which she said, "Why the fuck are you saying salad and running your hand through your hair?" Brackets. Despite all my poor features, I do indeed have decent salad. He says. Close brackets. How should I say to her that I'm using an obscure reference that I don't know the origin of, that I've heard three white guys, I don't know you need to say that, in their 30s, say on a podcast none of my friends listen to because it sounds funny, and also can you please tell me the origin of the term? Thanks, gents. Yours, regretfully, in cricket, J. Josh.
Crap, brackets there. I like parentheses. Yeah, like, more parentheses in questions.
That was actually hard to read.
The better. Yeah, well, and that's the problem. Like,
it's beautiful to read, you know, privately to yourself, but when you actually have to say the words out loud.
Well, you're not meant to use too many parentheses in writing. It's like little disclaimers, like undermines the power and the clarity of your message. It kind of suggests, oh, you don't really know what you're talking about. But I actually think it's good for cricket, which is just an endless war in your head of competing thoughts.
Because you start thinking something, then something else comes into your mind.
And you always do the opposite thing to the thing you're thinking in cricket.
Yes. It's like an antidote to the smug oversimplification of cricket, where everyone talks as though they know exactly what's going on when actuality they don't. Mm. When in reality
they don't.
What is the origin of Salah?
Well, I don't know. I think that's partly why it's funny, isn't it? Like, I mean, if someone has the etymology...
Did we start it?
I don't remember.
No, about the term salad?
Yeah.
No, someone else. So I've heard salad for a while.
I thought you said it and that you'd heard it at grade cricket level, because the first time I was ever introduced to the term was, I'm pretty sure, through you saying it and me being incredulous and not having any idea.
It's been around grade cricket for a while, and then it started popping up in our RTGCs, and we were just like, what is it? Because I just think about iceberg lettuce, cherry tomatoes, shredded carrot, beetroot, feta.
Pumpkin, walnut.
And how pumpkin, rocket, walnut, balsamic, and how does that translate to hair? How is that in any way? And then you think about that on someone's head.
This just struck me, this fucking entire podcast is parentheses. Someone says something, then someone says something else. Mm. Yeah.
If someone else can suggest the etymology of salad.
I think so. I started it. That's what we're coming to.
Oh, okay. I'd love to know.
I don't know.
Oh, I see, right.
Yeah.
Because you can play around with it. I guess you can play around with salads. You can add things to salads. You can add things to hair. You can style it differently. You can present a salad in many different ways.
Sure. Mm. Sure. Mm. Such as?
Mediterranean.
Look at Jack Weatherall.
Yeah.
Peri-peri chicken. I'm just going to list salads, which is just not good radio. Greek.
It's always funny to me when people write in, like, where they listen to this show. Like, people, like, obviously long drives and stuff. Is it Josh who just wrote that question? He was, like, saying
Josh,
like,
Paul.
He's driving to and from the Big Smoke or whatever. Mm. So I was talking to someone the other day. They're like, they have it on in, like, a radiology theatre. So it's just, like, on in the background. Like, people are, like, walking in and out.
Just doing,
on.
Like, 20-week ultrasounds.
Yeah, it's fucking just on. My friend listens to it, and he, like, plays it in the office and, like, in the radiology theatre. Like, why are you doing that to people? Why are you doing that? Anyway, get well soon.
Get well soon, Josh. Natasha writes in, and the subject is romance gone wrongen.
Nice. Oh, did you put a subject?
Yeah.
It was an email one.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Romance gone wrongen. That's actually a proper headline. Hi, the great cricketer.
G'day.
I just wanted to tell you the story about how 6 months ago I knew nothing about cricket and am now listening to your podcast on most car rides. Thanks to my boyfriend. I think he must have recognised that being such a cricket nuffy was probably not the most attractive feature when trying to date me. In fact, I had no idea that he even had the slightest interest in the game until a few months down the track. It wasn't until the Ashes were on last year that he started talking about the game with his dad. At first, I thought it was just a general interest for the sport. However, he proceeded to explain the game to me and told me it meant a lot to him, and then I showed some interest. At this point, I still wasn't aware of his obsession until he came over one day and his phone background was suddenly changed to a picture of Steve Smith, and then told me that no one was worthy of Steve Smith, not even me. But I was already in too deep. I then found myself watching videos explaining cricket to impress him, and that's when I knew there was definitely no going back. I'm now the proud owner of a sidearm and slightly enjoy going to the nets until I got a ball to the face. I genuinely enjoyed watching the Boxing Day test, or maybe it was just the beer, and I have a massive crush on Mitch Stark, to the point that my boyfriend is getting jealous. Dating a cricket addict is a dangerous, slippery slope, and I really should have gotten out at the first sign of him liking the game, but here we are, writing to you as a birthday present to him. I'm shamefully excited to watch more games at the SCG. Tash. P.S. Happy birthday, Harry.
Harry. Where are they? They're driving the car right now. They listen to this podcast.
Or in a radiology theatre.
Harry, you need to pull the car over right now and you marry this woman. It doesn't get any better than this. You're getting fucking throwdowns from Tash.
He did the right thing. I think we've talked about this on the podcast before. When do you reveal drip feeding your cricket obsession? Mm. Not too early. He waited 3 months till she was in. She was invested. Yeah. Maybe emotionally, maybe financially. Yeah.
He tricked her.
He tricked her. Mm-hmm. Pulled the wool over her eyes. Mm. And now she's in very deep. Yep. She's going
before
down
he told her that she wasn't worthy of Steve Smith.
Yeah.
Was that? Yes.
You're not worthy of him.
Yeah. No one's worthy of him.
It would have come as a real shock to the system. For Tash, I would have thought, oh, I'm dating this guy. I think he likes cricket. Now I'm not worthy of Steve Smith.
He's a bit leg side, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, notwithstanding the crush on Mitch Stark, though she spells his name with a K, so it might be an unintentional
alpha. That could have just been a correction.
True.
Or what I correct thing.
This is absolutely beautiful, and I'm touched. Harry will either... The question is how Harry will feel. He could feel extremely alarmed. I mean, maybe he liked to listen to TJC alone, and now his girlfriend is in the show.
The fuck's wrong with you, Harry? What's going on? What are your secrets? What's going on with you and Steve Smith?
But nah, that's nice.
Guess so.
Any other birthday messages? Send them in. Or whatever. Do we want?
Parentheses. Close parentheses. That's the end of the show. That's the end of the show. We haven't spoken to Michael Vaughan yet. Let's do this dance one more time. Who knows? I'm backing him. You backing him?
We've got his room number at the hotel he's staying at, and he's flying out this evening. And I'm pretty sure he's already checked out.
This only makes sense to us because people already know if he's been on.
Yeah, good point. Good point. That's the end of the show. All right. Well, I've done it again. See you guys next week.